Hello, friends. I'm Matt Baum. The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. If you like the show, head to patreon.com and look for Sewers of Paris to pledge your support. And hey, please join me for another live online video chat this weekend. I'd love to meet and talk to the folks who listen to the show. It's going to be this Saturday, January 30th, at noon Pacific time on YouTube. And the theme is Queer as Folk. You can chat along with us by going to my YouTube channel. The name is Matt Baume, M-A-T-T-B-A-U-M-E. I'll have more details at the end of the show, or find me at Matt Baume on Twitter for the link. And now, we're on a search for entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join me on tonight's episode when my guest Richard Day says...
So, I was just in a state of absolute terror and shock the whole time.
The topic is polyester, Gary Shandling, and Arrested Development. So many of us grew up in a sub to some city's urb, close enough to know that there's life beyond the split-level ranches and strip malls, but not close enough to know what that life actually is. My guest this week is Richard Day. Even as a kid, he could detect a mismatch between himself and the nice, normal, heterosexual world he'd grown up in. It's a gay cliche to find the suburbs boring or oppressive or hostile, but Richard discovered that they can also be funny. You just have to learn to pull back the veneer, sometimes way back, as he learned to do as a writer on shows like It's Gary Shandling Show, Ellen, and Arrested Development, and with his films Girls Will Be Girls and Straitjacket. It was on projects like these that Richard discovered a rich vein of comedy runs directly through normal. Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. I'm joined by writer-director Richard Day. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. This is my first podcast. No one has ever been interested in me being on their podcast before you.
Well, so let's dive right in. Tell me, what's the entertainment that changed your life?
Polyester was the one that really sprang to mind immediately when you asked me that question. The John Waters film from 81.
Oh, honey, today is going to be a new beginning. We're going to be a real family again.
Oh, Mom.
Oh, Dexter.
Oh. Welcome home, Dexter.
Hello, Lulu. Will you give your brother a kiss?
Dexter, forgive me for being so awful, but I've changed. Bobo's dead and I've had a miscarriage.
That's awful.
But I've discovered macrame.
Well, John Waters, I mean, I think most people know this, but yeah, I'll run it through just so for completeness' sake. He was an underground filmmaker who used Divine, a drag queen, as his star, and was kind of famous for, or notorious for, a couple of seconds of film, you know, of Divine eating dog shit in a film. But really, they were just camp extravaganzas that did get very coarse, but that was only one of their many kind of, you know, cartoony, underground, very hip vibes. You know, to me, thing that got the most notoriety was the least interesting thing about these films. And they were also really impossible to see, unless you lived in a big city, and, you know, I didn't. When the era we're talking about, I'm a teenager, and so these movies existed, but were not on my radar. And Polyester was his first film. I don't really know whether he had studio funding, but it was the first one to get an actual release in movie theaters, you know, that a kid growing up like me might have a chance to see.
Yeah, so just previously, they were just really hard to find the theaters that they were showing at, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know where they showed, but I'm presuming it was, you know, in San Francisco at perhaps the Castro Theater or, something like the Strand, or who knows. But it wasn't at the Multiplex. It wasn't, you know, in Novato, California, where I grew up. It was just a and they were banned in places. I mean, these were really considered, you know, outre things. And so Polyester was his first attempt to say, okay, here's a real movie, people. Like, this is not just something very hip for me and my, you know, underground friends. This is something for all of America. And it got that kind of release, you know. I don't know how big it was, but it came to me, and I was not at the center of anything.
So what did you see in the film that stuck with you?
It actually opened up whole new vistas in everything from content to form, and where I guess it's important to understand I was at this point. I'm like 17, and I know I want to be a comedy writer. And moreover, something like Saturday Night Live and things like that are just breaking big on the scene, and everybody is saying that's the future of comedy. Comedy has this whole new, fresh voice. And as a gay kid, without necessarily knowing that the reason why was that I was a gay kid, I didn't really respond to anything that they were putting forward. And it was just so heterosexual. I mean, Saturday Night Live, for instance, Animal House, which was the, you know, the big mainstream success of about exactly the same time as the movie we're talking about came out.
Well, that was pleasant. Nice of him to stop by, don't you think?
We've got to do something. He's serious this time. I think he knows about the exams.
He's right.
You're right. We got to do something.
Absolutely.
You know what we got to do? Toga party.
We're on double secret probation, whatever that is. We can't afford to have a toga party.
You guys up for a toga party?
Toga! Toga!
I think they like the idea, Hoof.
It's a movie that doesn't actually question that much. You know, it's straight people, and mostly, frankly, straight people that went to Harvard. I mean, very inside people, lampooning the things that they consider mockworthy, which wasn't even frats. Like, frats are even okay. It's just a particular kind of frat they had an issue with. And, you know, the rest of the world and society and the conventions and marriage and children and, you know, what a movie is, the Animal House was just fine with. It you know, it wanted to grow up and be Steven Spielberg. And John Waters, being gay, rejects all of it. And I'd never seen that in a movie before, where it's not just that, you know, you should be a cool frat instead of an uncool frat. It's basically saying every aspect of straight culture is mockworthy. Everything. I mean, not just the clueless parents, but also the selfish kids, and also the, you know, the sexuality of teenagers, and also, you know, every institution that you know, we love is something that he's going to put on the table. He's going to make fun of that. And, you know, now that sounds a little dated because there's YouTube and there's been The Simpsons and, you know, a million things, you know, more transgressive than it, obviously. But there's been so much of this sort of material that it yeah, of course you can make fun of anything, is what I kind of hear when I hear myself talk. That's what I think. But back then, that wasn't the case. Like, this, to me, was the first time that level of just lampooning the world at large and with such style had ever, you know, come. It's the first time I'd ever come across it. And so I guess that's probably why. Although at the time I just thought, wow, this is really funny. I want to make movies like that.
So what did you... What's the story of the movie in as much as it has like a narrative thread?
The thing that I love so much about it, and John Waters, and the thing that was so like liberating about it, is it's about something. It has a story in the same way that Rocky Horror has a story, but both of them, and mainly Polyester and John Waters, is making fun of you if you think a movie should have a story. It's not going to take movies seriously enough to give it a story or to shoot it a particular way. You know, you watch Animal House and you realize it's got a score, it's got professional actors, the director wants to go on and do Indiana Jones movies probably, you know, and John Waters comes along and he's, you know, this gay kid from Baltimore, and he's like saying, all of that is off the table for me. I'm not going to be the next Steven Spielberg, so don't ask me to take, you know, his gods seriously too. No, I'm not going to, you know, come up with interesting camera moves and a story that engages you. I'm just going to come up with a bunch of shit that I want to show you, and half the joke will be that it's a movie that you have to watch. I mean, seriously, like, he's got Edith Massey, who was the thrift store clerk where he would go to get costumes. I mean, just the woman behind the counter at the thrift store. And he said, okay, I'm going to put you in my movies. And she can't act, and she has no interest in acting, and she doesn't improve at all over the movies, you know, and she doesn't necessarily even seem to understand what she's saying. And he gives her really crucial roles in stories. So if you wanted to take Polyester's story seriously to the extent there is one.
You're so cute when you get tipsy.
Oh, Cuddles, I am an alcoholic.
Well, you should get out more then, honey, and forget your silly-nilly problem.
You gotta get me to the alcoholics meeting.
I'll take you to your club meeting, Francine, but first you're going shopping with me. I simply cannot stand another day undecided about my debutante gown.
I've gotta get to the alcoholics meeting.
He puts these huge roadblocks in your way. Like, okay, well, here's a main role played by somebody that can't even read. Okay, so go ahead. Now enjoy the story. You know, he's making fun of the idea that movies are worth respecting. And in the same way that he's making fun of the idea that, you know, society is worth respecting. And those things, you know, Things had never been called into question to that degree, at least for me at that time. And it was really incredibly, and remains, I think, liberating, because that's the joke of being gay, or at least it was when I was growing up, you know? You're being raised to slowly exposed to this whole society, this whole wonderful world, and then you realize you're gay, and the punchline is, oh yeah, none of that's for you. That's all for other people. And you, what's my role in it? We don't really have one. Just be very quiet about yourself and, you know, just exist in the margins of that and everyone will be fine. So, you know, I mean, if that's the role that society has for us, why respect society? Why present any of its institutions with reverence? And that's the freedom in John Waters' movies. And that's, you know, the freedom that I think gay audiences kind of hunger for, and at least in my case back then, couldn't articulate. I didn't know why this vision appealed to me so much, but it did. And I'm not really answering your question because, you know, to the extent there's a story at all, it's just this housewife is put through hell by everyone in her life, you know? But it's really not even about that. It's just a snapshot of the culture John Waters was forced to live in, you know, that takes itself so seriously, that respects itself so much. And John Waters saying, from my perspective, you guys look fucking ridiculous.
What are some of the things in the movie that made you laugh?
I couldn't tell you what I laughed at then. I will say that it was my first exposure to drag and the whole drag sensibility, which is, you know, something that is with me still. I still make drag movies myself. And it's just this take on life that is half cartoon and half satire and, oh dear, two halves make a whole. I've described a whole, and I've still got more to say. I should have been saying they're like a quarter of each of these things.
It's more than the sum of its parts.
Yes. You know, it's drag is kind of the vehicle through which one does camp. And as such, you know, it is never presenting itself at face value, and it is always trying to entertain on some level. It's just this exaggerated portrait of not really women, but gay men, you know, in feminine guise. In movies, it gets a little squishy because it's like the Muppets in movies where you see Kermit's feet and everything. It gets a little bit like, well, you know, drag is best done in a cabaret, in a gay bar, where it's just clearly a man, you know. But once you're in the naturalism of a movie, it gets a little squishy. I'm just sort of aware of that from my own films. But the underlying drag kind of ethos, regardless of that, is this take on gay men. Is this, you know, this sort of vile mouth, sexualized, fabulously dressed, but vice addled, you know, fabulous personality that has a terrible life, but approaches it with aplomb. And that's, you know, what Divine does in all of these movies. I mean, Divine, what I love about this one, though, I mean, I'm a little all over the place because it isn't just a pure expression of drag. Polyester is so much richer than that, that yes, that exists, and that's probably what I laughed at the most, because I'm still making those kind of jokes myself, and this was my first exposure to it, so I'm going to put that down as the thing that it really opened my eyes to, which was the comedy form of drag. But, you know, then the movie has so many other layers that I can go into as well.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, what are the things that made you laugh about it then, and are they different from what made you laugh now?
It's a comedy, and I'm laughing throughout, but it's also drag, and it's also camp, so it's not comic scenes in the way that you get in, you know, a Melissa McCarthy movie, where isn't it funny that a housewife is a spy and has to hide that... I haven't seen that film, but, you know, I mean, they're very, very cleverly constructed comic premises that you watch play out with actual jokes, and you know when you're supposed to laugh. And Polyester and this sort of film doesn't really have any of that. It's all vibe. You know, it's all just you start laughing because, for instance, these bad things start happening to Divine. Just people in her life betraying her, one after the other after the other. You know, her mother and her children and her husband, you know, and her lover that she takes. And she's got one reaction to it, which is this sort of wail, this sort of just over-the-top, like a 50s movie parody wail of woe is me. And there is this sustained, like, 20-minute period in the film where she's just doing only that. Where I would say her only line is this plaintive wail at some injustice that she's just experienced that start piling on each other so fast, and they don't stop, that becomes hilarious. I mean, just the idea that you're watching that. I mean, I don't even know at what point you start laughing, and there isn't really a joke point. It's a level of absurdity, you know, that's running through this thing. I don't know when you start laughing at the idea that Edith Massey is in this film. Or, you know, if it's carryover from the other movie you probably saw where she was also doing the exact same thing. But it's fucking hysterical that he's taking people that have no business being in movies and just shoving them front and center and saying, okay, here are your lines. However you read them is fine with me. I mean, that is... You don't see that anywhere. Is there a formal point where it's funny? I don't know. It just... You know, the production design is so over the top. There's... It is, you know, this whole polyester era. It's not presented in the way that Tim Burton would be doing it, where, you know, you just get this money shot of, you know, isn't it funny that these people have this kind of no taste? And here it is in this one shot, and now back to our film. It's instead suffuses everything. So at what point do you notice that everything they're wearing and everything around them is tacky? I mean, or that they're only eating things like cake. You know, I mean, it's just, it's very deadpan. So, but it suffuses the film. So, I would say once you start laughing, if it's your cup of tea, certainly back when it was released, you just don't stop, and it's hard to even put your finger on why you're laughing.
So, you mentioned that you're growing up in Novato. What kind of environment were you growing up in?
Well, Novato is in Marin County, which is north of San Francisco, and so you know, Marin County is kind of famously progressive, wealthy, irritating. You know. sort of people, and now there's Silicon Valley there in that general area, so it's even worse. But Novato was at the absolute outer realm of that, and that's where everybody's cops and firemen could afford to buy houses back then. And so, you know, my dad was a teacher and my mom was a nurse, and that's what they could afford. So that's where I grew up. It's beautiful. It's got rolling hills and, you know, churches with steeples and all of that. But it's the children of firemen and cops that you're growing up with, so you get beat up a lot. You know, there's not a lot of open-mindedness going on.
You were at the bottom of the totem pole?
Oh, totally. I mean, yeah, I don't know that people knew what gay was enough to understand that I was gay, but I was definitely not, you know, one of them. So it was kind of the environment, I guess what I'm saying is, that he's making fun of. You know, it is that kind of just off-the-rack suburbia is what Novato is, that polyester is really raking over the coal. So that probably has something to do with it as well.
So it must have seemed kind of familiar what you were seeing, but like an Emperor Has No Clothes version of suburbia.
Yeah, and I'm a little self-conscious like saying it that way just because that's such a trope now. I mean, you just see that everywhere, or not even so much anymore, but there came to be the era where suburbia was on the comedy operating table and everybody got their licks in, and now we all know what we think about it. But back then, there hadn't been. There hadn't even been the Wonder Years. You know, there'd been nothing. Suburbia wasn't really Spielberg showed it. He was probably the first, like, filmmaker that anybody noticed was actually showing suburbia, and then, you know, right on the heels of that, polyester comes along and just tears it to shreds. So there is that. I'm just trying to think, like, it's also the case, though, and I really can't like stress this enough, that that's what the movie's doing to the extent that it's bothering to do it. It's not focused satire. It's John Waters. I mean, you know, and as I said before, like half of what he's doing is making fun of the idea of the fact that he's making a movie and that you're watching a movie, and a lot of the pleasure of a John Waters movie is that it is really kind of a threadbare affair. That, you know, just like the gays get the worst sections in town and the cheapest bars, or back in the day certainly, you know, we get a couple of movies, it turns out, but you have to make them yourself and they look like shit and they don't star real actors. And when you're watching that sort of film, you can practically see the lights off camera, but more to the point, you can practically see John Waters off camera and you can pretty much pretend you're there too. And I really think that might actually be the key to what's so amazing about, for me, this film specifically, but I think, you know, John Waters' early films in general, is that they're not Star Wars. You're not impressed with anybody's, you know, filmmaking technique or transported to any other world. You're really aware somebody is making a movie with camera and lights. And what I mean by that is you feel like you are on that set, and that's a very cool place to be for certainly a 17-year-old closeted gay kid, you know, to have these kind of friends that make this kind of film. And by virtue of watching the movie, I'm practically there, because there's only probably four other people off camera, you know. So it's this very small kind of fun group to pretend you're part of, and I did. I mean, you know, it just makes you feel like you're part of that cool crowd that's making this movie, and that might be another reason why what movie they're making is interesting. It's not the point.
So did you feel like when you saw it, did you feel like you were part of it, and you wanted to more? You wanted to be a part of that, like going ahead for your life?
Yeah, I mean, I really felt like, wow, it's possible for me to do this. I mean, I don't know that I was thinking in terms like that, but I really was. I'm aware now that what I was feeling at the time was, it's great that straight people have Saturday Night Live, but that's not my voice. Saturday Night Live very much was the popular kids at high school telling, you know, being kind of bullies about what's funny and what isn't, and they're all going to grow up to be senators. I think it's, you know, it's interesting that the most outlandish character in Animal House grows up to be a senator, and it's a joke, ha ha ha, isn't that unlikely? But not that unlikely. Al Franken's a senator now. You know, it's like that was actually the track those people were on. They were very much on the inside, so much more than gay people who just stand outside of it all. So if you're 17 and you're thinking, maybe I'm going to go into comedy, you don't really know, but maybe I'll be a filmmaker, what does that mean? Well, it means I'm going to have to do romantic comedies or these things these Saturday Night Live people are doing, which just look stupid. You know, there's so much more I would make fun of than the couple of things about college they choose to make fun of, you know? There's plenty in that movie they're not making fun of. You know, it seems to be Harvard. They're not making fun of Harvard. You know, it's the college is fine. It needs a new dean, maybe. But they have no problem with college. They have no problem with dating. They have problem with old people. You know, they're not really comfortable with black people. It's just kind of so limited what was on the table in a Saturday Night Live comic universe. And Paul Esther comes along and says, no, it not only is it everything, but it is your specific things, gay boy. You know, it is the things that you find funny, that gay people just, you can't generalize completely, but there is a gay sensibility. And I didn't know about it. And I certainly didn't know that you could work in that voice and end up at the local multiplex. I mean, that opened up, you know, that's what I ended up doing with my life, frankly. So it's like it really made a big impression on me.
So what was it about comedy? Like at what point were you like, oh, this is something that I want to do. I want to make people laugh.
That's a really good question. And I don't completely know the answer, because I think all comedy writers come to it the same way, where we find out we're funny. Like in high school, people start laughing at us, and we start, you know, and our senses of humor, we start to express them in more formalized way. Like, I don't know, becoming a stand-up comedian or writing little sketches for the high school plays or making little movies or, you know, I mean, and now Vines, I'm sure, are, you know, things like that. But it's like you just kind of start doing it and getting positive feedback and then falling into it. Like, I don't remember ever having to or choosing to go into comedy. It was just by the time I was old enough to understand I was going to be doing something as an adult, it was going to be comedy. And it might have all gone differently if I hadn't been allowed, but that was the first thing I tried, and it worked. So, you know. But, oh, by the way, but yes, you know, I'm it was watching things like this that did it. And in my earliest incarnation, you know, 13, 14, of this idea, it was probably Monty Python. And then SCTV. I never really got into SNL, but SNL would end and SCTV would come on, and I was just really all about what they were doing, which was parody.
Did you have like funny sketches or favorite characters? Did you have favorite sketches?
I had favorite performers, like on SCTV. Yeah, anytime Dave Thomas and Rick Moranis were doing something, you knew it was going to be good. You know, and Catherine O'Hara was great, but she left right away, unfortunately.
Next topic. Okay, next topic's back bacon, and look what happens when you overcook it. It shrivels up, right?
You put beer in that. That's why I did that.
No, we always put beer in that.
You know, we used to use margarine. Now we use beer.
We always use
beer. For, like, eggs, eh? To keep it from sticking the pan, you pour beer in.
Like, why is there no back bacon-flavored gum? That'd be great, right? Mm. So that's our show for today.
It's kind of funny that the folks who had the voice that you recognized, that you felt like you could be a part of, where it was coming from another country.
Isn't that Interesting. Yeah, I mean, you're right. It was coming from Canada. They were shooting it up there, too. It was outsiders. And I think, well, I mean, kind of famously, comedy is an outsider looking in. And you're being told by the country, you should want this, but, oh, you can't have it. I mean, that's kind of the person that's told that, whether it's women or Jews or gays or blacks, anybody outside of, you know, the sweet spot develops, well, there are many possible reactions, but one of them is a comic reaction, and it's half fuck you and half no please, I really do want in. You know, I mean, if you really didn't care about it, it wouldn't occupy your attention. But you know, we're all human, we all want to be part of the in crowd, and the in crowd is this, so great, except they won't let us in. Well, fine, then I'm going to make fun of it, and this is what's funny about it, and this is what's funny about it. And it's also like a way, it's almost a way of then entree into it, because, well, okay, if you're going to be funny, you can come in. You know, and so it's even got that about it. But gays, I think, of all of those, you know, to the extent comedy is about that, I think gays are like the most logical extreme of that, because, you know, women are allowed into society, but you're supposed to stay in these very particular roles. And gays, no. You're either hated to the extent we know you exist, or you're just not factored into the idea. I mean, these are circa 1980, obviously, but so if you're completely outside, it's all up for grabs. I mean, that's like the, and you totally want in because you're living among it. That is a really strong comic position. You know, to me, it's funny that Harvard throws off all these comedy artists, because in my mind, that's the most disadvantaged place to do comedy from. You're at the epicenter of white privilege, access, you know, status quo. The world is designed for you, and you've got no complaints about any of it. And you're going to do comedy from that position. It's you know, it's gay is the opposite of that.
You know, you mentioned that you felt like gays are sort of a natural conduit for that voice of the outsider. Did you have, growing up there in a kind of a suburb of San Francisco, did you have a lot of influence about what gays were?
Yes and no. I mean, it all came from the fact that it's a satellite city of San Francisco, so you get the San Francisco paper, which is the San Francisco Chronicle, and basically gay liberation is going on. This is the 70s. So you get a lot of front page headlines about riots and marches and, you know, hand-wringing sort of editorials about, is this a good thing? And I mean, as a kid, you're kind of like, you know, you mainly read the comics and, in my case, the entertainment section too. But whenever there was like a gay thing, you'd pull it over. And the thing I would say about it is, you know, back then, even the San Francisco Chronicle is not on board exactly. They'll cover it. It's news in their city. But, you know, they're not. No one is accepting of this. It's a very straight perspective, and it's very dubious about the gays, but not outright hostile. So I guess what I'm saying is, like, as a kid, you read these articles, and you become aware this exists, and it's very fraught. It's very serious. People are very upset about it, and it involves a lot of anger and arrests. And then if you watch the TV movies that we did get, you know, it's like a lot of crying and a lot of murder goes with it too. That's kind of the gay influence that seeps into, like, you know, even a kid growing up around San Francisco at that era. And that was another way that Polyester, I think, was revelatory without necessarily knowing it, because there's no gay characters in it, but the whole movie is so gay in its sensibility. And where is that so lightly? It's not, you know, a TV movie starring Marlo Thomas about her gay son, and she's crying through the whole thing, and I can't remember if he gets murdered in that one. I think he's okay in that one, but there's one where the kid gets murdered, and instead it's like, no, that's fun. We're going to put Divine in a dress, and we're going to, you know, there's smell-o-rama, and everything is fabulous looking, and it's, you know, 80 minutes, and you get to go on with your life, and that's how important gay is. That's how serious gay is. It's not serious at all. It's just fun. It's just, you know, another part of life. And that was, you know, that I didn't know that. There were no gay people, certainly, in my day-to-day life that I could look at and use them as any kind of role model, not in Nevada.
How long did you know that you were gay?
13, I guess, you know, the minute you're sexually, but it's different for everybody, but, you know, the minute you just come online sexually, you realize, oh, this is going to be a problem. I like the guys.
Were you making projects at the time? Like, were you doing comedy then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were making little movies, and, you know, my friends and me, and I was writing a lot of comedy sketches. And
what kind of stuff would you write?
I wouldn't say I was a precocious genius or anything. It was probably pretty juvenile stuff. But I remember it being like, you know, parody, you know, principally. Like, we made a movie when I was 15 starring a vampire private detective. It doesn't have sound, and I don't even know that we finished it, but that just sort of gives you some idea of, you know.
So, yeah, how did you get from Novato to Los Angeles where you're actually working on big projects?
Well, there was this very specific, strange thing called Video West, which was an organization of video artists in San Francisco. Back then, the only sort of city that would think to do something like that. It wasn't the center of the world back then. It was just a tourist town where you went to drop out. So these video artists from art school were making these, you know, kind of like John Waters was, just for no reason other than that it interested them, were making video segments. And they had a rock music component. They had a lot of access to the local bands, and there were comedy sketches. And they got a contract, or maybe the PBS station said, well, you guys have a good heart. We'll give you a half hour of time. I'm sure they didn't get any money for it. You know, on Sunday night at midnight, and I would watch that, and it looked just like a John, you know, it's not the same sensibility, but it has that same kind of gonzo vibe that John Waters stuff has, and I just, there's a phone number at the end of it, that's how, you know, untraditional it was, and I called the number, and they said, okay, great, send us your stuff, and I sent them my stuff, and they said, great, we're going to shoot some of this, and then I worked for them for a while. I mean, I didn't get paid, but, you know, I got stuff on TV. You know, as an 18-year-old kid, like, I mean, and it wasn't that I was so, you know, the point isn't that it's interesting that I'm doing it as 18. It's interesting that this company was so open-minded that they would consider an 18-year-old kid, you know, but that's who they were. And then all of us who were doing that kind of went into music video, because music video exploded right then, and we had access to all these bands. So we started making actual music videos that got on MTV, and then we all moved to Los Angeles and, you know, had various fates, but I went into sitcom right away, and, you know, right when it was booming.
When you started making stuff with Video West, what kind of stuff did you see? Like, what kind of stuff did you make? What did you put on the screen?
Well, let's see. They did a comedy sketch called Invasion of the Killer Bees, and it was the letter B instead of an actual B. And this was a director named Joe Day, who is still my friend, did this. And he, you know, would take the letter B and put it on a pole and put a piece of fishing line on it and dangle it over people's heads and have a bee burst out of people's chests. I mean, it is what it is, but it was that kind of thing. But, you know, it's like these people are 22 and they're just, you know, it was funny to them to do that. And, you know, there was that one. There was a comedy sketch about, it's hard to explain. Like, I mean, a husband coming home and from prison and discovering his wife is remarried. I mean, and then that just turned into this kind of dissection of how fraudulent straight relationships are. I guess that was one that I did that they shot. You know, that was an interesting thing. That you know that why they shot that one? I don't know. You know, because their show was just, here's a bunch of shit we did this week. That was Video West. It didn't have a theme. It wasn't asking viewers to, like, you know, here's a rock video magazine. It wasn't that. It was just, here's a bunch of shit we made. It was YouTube, only 40 years before YouTube.
When you were passing through San Francisco on the way to LA, did that help you figure out how to be gay?
Oh, God, yes. I mean, I think it was essential. In fact, I think that I never quite recovered from how helpful it was. Because, I mean, I also grew up there, I grew up near there. And you go to San Francisco, and this is way back, what are we talking, 1981. And I swear, it was as advanced, the culture that you end up hanging out in was as advanced toward, you know, LGBT equality then as the rest of the world. And I don't even mean the outbacks. I mean, like, Los Angeles is just getting to where San Francisco was then. So it was actually kind of startling to come out in San Francisco and have it be absolutely no big deal. And you'd go to movies, and if there was any, you know, vaguely anti-gay sentiment on screen, the whole audience, or not the whole audience, but the lesbians would hiss. Really, I mean, you know, it just makes you feel like, oh, this is no big deal. That same sense you got in a John Waters film of, you got living in San Francisco, then it's, oh, I thought this was going to ruin my life. I thought this was going to really circumscribe what I could do. But apparently it's no big deal. And then you leave San Francisco and you realize, oh, that's just there. You know, it actually is a big deal everywhere else. Certainly in Los Angeles it was. It wasn't, people were not cool with me being gay in Los Angeles. I mean, they said they were, but they didn't want to hear about it. They, you know, made little comments. It was just, you know, you were always a little bit outside the staffs on TV shows, you know. It was just not at all the same experience. And I just, and that's Los Angeles, you know. It was another fairly big city in California.
So when you did land in L.A., you mentioned that you got to work on sitcoms. How did you get started?
It's really easy. It was then, because there were sitcoms all over the place, and they just all needed writers, and they needed writers in excess of what there actually were. So you just get yourself noticed, and if you're good, and it's not that hard, it wasn't that hard then. I mean, you write a couple of spec scripts. I was in this AFI program that NBC underwrote to find writers, and after that, they just start, you know, they're looking. Some show will hire you, give you a shot.
So who hired you?
Oh, the first show that hired me was It's Gary Shandling's Show, which was on Showtime. And they don't really run it much, but it was like a really, you know, A-list, you know, a comedy writer's sort of favorite critical darling that helped enormously. Because that's your first credit. You got a long way to fall. You can get like 10 jobs off of that if you're a complete fraud before they completely find you out.
Describe what that show was like. Because it's really, there's nothing like it.
No, and there still hasn't been. I mean, to an extent, Fred Allen in the 50s did some of this stuff. You know, a few other people when TV was new. But what he did was he just did a four-camera sitcom like everybody else was doing. And then the conceit is he's living in a four-camera sitcom. And it's never, you know, worked out like the Marvel universe, you know, hermetically sealed and absolutely, he's not, you know, it's like, it is, again, like a John Waters movie where half the joke is, yeah, I didn't really think this through. What do you want? It's not real. It's a TV show. That's the point. Why would I, you know, yes, this could never happen. But so, you know, so the rules are really fluid, but they include things like he's got to go to his friend Pete's house, so he'll just walk off the stage and past the audience and past the crew and, you know, the agents watching the monitors, and then to the next set, which is only three walls, which is Pete's house, and then continue the scene. And so sometimes it's just that, and sometimes it's like Pete's family. Ed Solomon wrote this episode that it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen on TV. And it was one, you know, Gary's best friend's family wins a trip to Hollywood, and then they go to Hollywood and they get tickets to It's Gary Shandling's Show. So they're in the audience watching the show as Gary is, I think he's feeding their fish because they're in Hollywood, you know, and he betrays the teenage son's personal secret. And because he's on TV now, everyone will know. And because that kid is in the audience, he stands up and screams, "Go to hell, Gary!" And it's just, you know, I can't explain what that premise is, but it's genius. You know, it's just taking the form and making it part of the content, and it's so hip. That's what and that's what I love about John Waters too. Because here's the thing that I think, I don't know why this, I'm connecting this with gay, but I swear it's a gay thing. Like, here's the thing about movies. They're fake. None of this happened. It's just actors, you know? And they're just dressing up and pretending. And it's so obvious that that's what it is, that why would you preserve that reality? You can't ever. You know, you're never going to get people to believe this is real. So in the service of trying to trick people into believing this is real, you're gonna ignore all this fun you could be having, you know, with showing the cameras and casting non-actors and watching them non-act. I mean, you know, it had that quality about it. So I guess in a way, it was camp. I just never thought of it that way before.
So how did it feel to be working on this show that was doing such incredible things that really resonated with you?
Well, what you also have to understand is that first-year comedy writers are useless. So I was just in a state of absolute terror and shock the whole time, that I went from the funniest person I know to the absolute least funny person in the room. You know, and look, that remains the most high-powered comedy room I've ever been a part of. Sam Simon, who just died up, created The Simpsons, and Max Prost and Tom Gamble and Ed Solomon, like I said, and Alan Zweibel and Gary Shandling and Al Jean and Mike Reese, who were doing The Simpsons. Now it's like, you know, just every person in that room was a hotshot comedy writer. And then this kid from Novato, it's his first job. And this is the case with all first-year writers. You just sit there going, I don't know how to do this. And then you pitch something, and everyone just looks at you for a minute and then goes on writing the show. So I wouldn't say I was a major creative force in the show, because that's just the nature of being a first-year writer on a show. But I was proud to have been there while it happened, if that means anything.
How did you develop a better skill for writing comedy, and how did you feel more confident about what you were putting out?
It's similar to San Francisco, where it turns out that's not what the real world was like. You know, that was this crazy, super talented room. And so I got, by the end of the year, you know, good enough to get some jokes in and write a couple scripts and, you know, not be considered complete dead weight, but certainly not standing out or perhaps even pulling my own in that environment with that staff. But then my next job, it was like, wow, I'm the funniest person here. There's nobody funny here. And then you realize, like, you know, that was the case with most TV shows. The reason they're not that funny is, you know, the staffs aren't that good a lot of times. And back then, I don't know what it's like now, but back then when there were 100 shows on the air, you know, there weren't 100 shows worth of good writers. So, you know, it turned out it was a much easier job than that first year had led me to believe. And then I was, and then once you, you know, get that confidence, then you grow as a writer and into whatever you're going to end up being. And so it was trial by fire, that show, but it ultimately was the only huge bump in ramping up anyway.
So was there a project that you worked on at some point where you're like, this is for the first time I'm really making what I want to be making?
Yeah, there were a few. I would say the first one might have been Ellen, because she's gay and she wasn't comfortable like being gay on screen, but it still kind of suffused, you know, the character. Even if she wasn't actually dating women, she's playing a lesbian, essentially, you know, minus the sexuality on that show. And you could just have a lot. And also, because she doesn't want to do dating material, which was the bread and butter of non-family sitcoms at the time, that meant you had to do something completely different. So we would come up with, I mean, you know, she'd go on American Gladiators and she'd take ballet lessons and, you know, end up in some ballet. And I mean, it was just like fun. It was a chance to like kind of really stretch, and whatever silly idea you had, as long as it wasn't her dating a man, she was up for it.
I can melt her.
Can I help you?
I'm Adam Green. I'm here to try out.
And I'm just here to watch. We don't allow spectators. You'll have to wait outside.
Oh, but I'm his mother.
Gladiator rules. The only way you could stay here is if you tried out yourself.
No, I don't think so.
You look like you're in pretty good shape.
Well,
it would be a chance for you to test yourself, to pitch yourself against the best and see how you measure up.
That's true. And it is kind of hot outside. What the hell?
And so I did a lot of work I really liked there. And then after that, there was a whole series of things, you know, leading to Arrested Development, which was, I mean, that's probably where I felt the absolute most at home, because I was at the peak of whatever my skills are. And that was the best show on TV. And it was also, you know, all of the things we're talking about. There was nothing that wasn't on the table. Everything was mockworthy in that show. And it's even using its form as a comic tool.
You're a chicken. Cuckoo-ca-cha! Cuckoo-ca-cha!
Yeah. What are you doing?
Michael and women? A
coodle-doo-ca-cha!
That's what I was just telling you.
Look, I haven't found the right girl. When I do, I will ask her out. Has anyone in this family ever even seen a chicken?
You mentioned that it was an environment where you could just have, you could suggest anything and it was all on the table. So what was the room like? I mean, was it just like, oh my God, we just have free reign?
Yes, it was absolutely that. And you don't get that in TV. And a lot of times, I mean, in fairness, you don't get that because the network won't stand for it. My problem with TV is often that the writers who are doing shows are kind of very timid in what they even want to do. And I always feel like a show can be a huge wasted opportunity where they don't want to make fun of anything much. They just want to, you know, work in TV, which means playing the game, you know, which means not rocking the boat. And the genius of Mitch was he realized, oh my God, their eyes are off the ball here. I can write. You know, ordinarily, you have to pitch the network exactly what they want, and then they make it even more what they want. But nobody is paying attention to like what the show is going to be about. So he does not waste the opportunity. He pitches the most outlandish, you know, show he's always wanted to most do, and they let him, You know, and by the time anyone realizes, which I guess they did halfway through the first season, oh, wait, this isn't a normal TV show at all. We have to start giving him notes. You know, the precedent had been set. The thing was up and running, and you know, and it never, it was never subjected to that kind of soul-crushing process that can ruin perfectly good TV show ideas, you know?
You know, what's funny is it kind of does the same thing that you were describing Polyester doing, where it takes a sort of suburban life and it's like, look at all the zaniness and look at how ridiculous this heterosexual world is.
Exactly. Which is funny because Mitch is straight and Jimmy is straight, his writing partner. I mean, you know, and most of the people on the staff, although not all, were straight, you know? But it is a very kind of camp view of suburban life and the suburban sitcom. You're exactly right. I mean, it's got sexuality between parents and children in a sitcom. You don't get that. You know, Modern Family is not going to do the isn't incest hilarious story. You know,
and Jessica Walter's character in particular is such a like a gay man's creation.
Yeah, I mean, in a slightly different world, Charles Bush would be playing the character, you're right.
Everything I do is so dramatic and flamboyant, it just makes me want to set myself on fire.
But Jessica Walters is amazing, and I'm you're right. I mean, I hadn't really thought of it that way, because I just sort of, it's just this show that I worked on. But it has a lot of similarities in terms of its approach to material, as the John Waters movie, certainly, that we're talking about. And camp in general, yeah, this larger-than-life, sex-obsessed, kind of like out-for-herself hedonist. Yeah, that is very much a drag kind of creation. I'd never thought of it that way.
So at what point did you start making your own movies? How did that happen?
I got my feet wet when I went to New York to do the show Spin City, and there were all these plays there, and I thought, oh, this will be fun. I'll do a play. And, you know, they were paying me pretty well. So I rented a theater and put up this play, and it was a huge bomb. It was just everybody hated it. And I'm not here to say it was necessarily any good. As its creator, I have a huge affection for it, and I later made it into the movie Straight Jacket, which was also completely ignored. But that was the first experience that I had with, okay, I'm not going to get Universal to make my movies, so I'm going to put them on myself. And in New York, that means put on a play. And in Los Angeles, that means make a movie. So I come back to L.A., and I get that deal with Imagine. And the first thing that I bring Imagine is Girls Will Be Girls. You know, I have tapes of Varla and tapes of Coco and tapes of Evie. And I say, I want to do the Golden Girls, but with these people.
Let me help you with your duffel bag.
My things are in the cabriolet.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's just your ass.
So I sold it myself to Showtime, who bought it, who bought two scripts. And so we wrote two scripts. And then they read it and they passed. And maybe they were smart to pass. I don't know. I just know suddenly we've got these two scripts, and I really believe in the project, and I've already put on a play in New York. So I call up all the casts, and I call up Jack, and I call up Jeffrey, and I call up Clinton, and I say, okay, I want to do this as a play. And Clinton just says, I am not putting on that dress and wig every single night for $15. Just shoot it once as a movie. You know? And so I was like, okay. That's how it happened. I mean, it then sort of spun into something slightly bigger, you know, once we actually did it. But it was, and I believe Clinton would have done the play. I'm not even saying he wouldn't, but that was his reaction. That was what caused us to do the film.
So for folks who aren't familiar with Girls Will Be Girls, which is shame on them, describe, like, you said it was kind of Golden Girls with drag queens.
Yeah, which is, I think, a good way to describe it, because it started life as a TV pitch, and so it's not really the story of a drag, you know, character who does this one amazing thing the way that a film might be. It's these three drag characters live together. Usually when movies have drag queens, it's about drag. It's La Cage aux Folles, it's, you know, Tu Wong Fu, and it's those sorts of things where straight men generally play them, and it's just about these irrepressible people that put on dresses and change this small town forever, or whatever. And that's not what drag is. Drag is what happens after you put on the dress. It's the character, you know, that you do in the nightclub. That's drag. You know, drag is not this tragedy. It's not, and you're certainly not E.T., you know, making little towns better. You're just this, you know, it's these kind of fabulous energy and attitude. You know, it's a whole comedic voice that you just only seem to get from drag, which means most people haven't had a lot of exposure to it, or hadn't, you know, when we were doing the film, certainly. And, you know, the movie was trying to present drag, the drag comic energy in film form, which, yes, John Waters had beat me to it 20 years earlier, but we had three of them. He only had one. So, you know, that was the idea. That's the movie. The movie is this old character, this young character, and this kind of, like, dishwater, you know, drab housewife live together in this house in Hollywood and their misadventures. And, you know, there's the movie and there's some internet shorts and now there's going to be another movie, which is to say it's sort of a TV series. The story keeps changing. The point isn't the story. The point is the characters and you know, that underlying situation.
And then, you know, Straightjacket followed that, the movie Straightjacket, and then that has a much more, I think it has a kind of a lot more sincerity.
Straightjacket was a riff on something else that I really like, which are, you know, 50s comedies in all their kind of arch, cartoony innocence. And they all star Rock Hudson, which is hilarious because they're all love stories and he's gay, you know, and they all kind of have this very stylized gay vibe. And the idea behind Straightjacket was, well, what if one of those movies was about Rock Hudson, you know, who had to get married to a woman he didn't love so he could continue to be a movie star, which is a perfectly glamorous profession of the sort that Rock Hudson would play in those sorts of films.
I always say, without my fans, I'd be no better than they are.
You know, it all lined up in my head really cleanly, and to an extent exists on film. Unfortunately, we didn't have the money of those movies, and I always think that's the thing on Straightjacket that I can never get quite past, is like, to do that right, you really have to have the same budget as those films, and we didn't. So we're really struggling just to pull off period, let alone style, you know, on that kind of a budget. And so, you know, I wish I could go back and make it with $10 million instead of a few hundred thousand.
Is there a type of movie or like a kind of story that is still in you that you haven't told yet that you really want to?
Oh, God, yeah, lots. Lots and lots and lots. I mean, I have the actual screenplays, in fact. It's just really impossible to get movies made. So that's always been the battle especially as a gay filmmaker, you can't, there's no career for a gay filmmaker making gay movies. You just basically self-finance them until you're tired of doing that and then you stop. There's no crossover into the professional gay cinema. That doesn't exist. so you can do straight movies, I guess, which I'm not saying I'm opposed to, but I will also say this, that Girls Will Be Girls has a profile in the gay community. I'm not saying that everybody has heard of it, but it's not all that unusual to mention it and have somebody know what you're talking about with Girls Will Be Girls. It does not have that in the straight world. You know, it's invisible. They didn't know that it had come out. They don't know that it exists, and no one much cares when they learn. It's just, it's not straight cinema. So the straight people that hire you and that finance your movies, you know, to them, I'm a first-time director. I've never done anything, because the only thing I've done is this drag movie that everyone thinks they know what it is just when you say that term. And so it's just very hard for me to get movies made. Like, I haven't been able to. So I have ones ready to go. I'd love to do. Yes, several, but... And in terms of which one I most want to do next, it's whatever one anyone will give me money to do. That's always the problem.
What do you think of the young you growing up in Nevada? Would that kid be into the movies and the projects that you're making now?
Oh, yeah. I think so. I mean, I can get as pretentious as anybody. Like, some of these things that I've written, I think I would have been bored by as a 17-year-old. But, yeah, Girls Will Be Girls. I think if I had seen that, you know, instead of Polyester, it would have had the same effect on me, because it's, you know, it's working the same side of the street.
You know, you say that the movies that you've made, are, you know, kind of exist within the bubble of the gay world, but it seems like you're kind of through all of the more mainstream sitcoms and other projects that you've worked on, that your voice is actually kind of infiltrating into the world, the mainstream world, the suburbs.
That's absolutely true. I've worked on big shows that have, you know, been big hits in the ratings or critically acclaimed ones that, you know, sort of the in quotes right people have watched, and, you know, I've gotten my share of material on those. It's the nature of TV, though, that I really think if I had never been born, all those shows would exist in virtually identical form, regardless. It's just, you know, you're working for a larger enterprise than yourself, and it's hard to make a huge dent. Like, I don't know. I know that I put gay stuff into the Drew Carey show, but I don't know that it, you know, it made it any gayer or was something that a gay kid would pick up on exactly.
Well, you know, I think, you know, it's sort of a kind of a butterfly effect where, you know, you put one joke in and that kind of gives permission for other jokes. And, you know, I certainly, like, growing up and watching Drew Carey, I, you know, would notice, you know, like, I don't know if this is a time when you were working on it, but when they had that, there were all the musical episodes and there's the dance-off between Rocky Horror and Priscilla at the end of one episode, like, that was really meaningful for me. Like, those were cultural milestones that I was like, oh, the show understands.
Yeah, you know, and no, I wasn't there for those, so that's Bruce Helford, who's, you know, a wonderful person, as straight as they come, you know? I mean, he's, as far as I know. He has that sensibility, too, because you're right. The Drew Carey Show was always pushing boundaries as well, different boundaries. I mean, not ones of content restriction, what you can show, but, it, you know, sitcoms didn't do a lot of musical numbers or have a lot of aliens or, you know, kind of work in that cartoony realm that he did that show with.
Well, you know, it sounds like, you know, it's sort of you know, rather than who's pushing at what boundaries, it sounds like you find a team where everyone's pushing at a boundary together.
Yeah, and it's and when you can find it, if you can find it, you're stay there because it's really rare.
And, you know, I know that Girls Will Be Girls, that, you know, just continues to have a life after the first movie. So is that a realm where you can have that creative world where there's no, you know, notes from someone higher up and you can just make the world that you want to make?
Yeah, absolutely. It is, you know, it will end up, for better or worse, being my life's work. Girls Will Be Girls. That'll be the thing that, if I ever did anything, you know, that gets mentioned in an obituary, it'll be Girls Will Be Girls. You know, I wouldn't say it's my voice because I am piggybacking on three incredibly talented performers and the work that they had done independently before I ever showed up, but I just took to it and made it into something that I would say is my own. You know, and there's nobody saying you can or can't do this, and there's no real presumed audience, you know, to pander to. You know, it's got some people that like it, but they like it. You know, they're on board. They want to see what we want to do next. So it's very liberating. And there's a new movie that I've been taking a comically long time to finish, just because of many reasons that are boring. But I'm really aware when I'm working on it, wow, this is just my vision. Like, there's nobody that I had to run this by, or I didn't write it thinking if I wrote it a certain way I would get funding, and there was nobody that had funded it saying take this out or cast this person. There was, you know, just the limitations of we don't have any money, but that's kind of baked into the premise too. So it's, you know, it's another movie where I can really stand behind everything. I can say this is what I think is good. You know, it's light on its feet. It's consistently funny, and it's trying to shock you, but in a good natured way. And I love it. I mean, I love the experience of working on Girls Will Be Girls. I hope to do another one after this if I ever finish this one.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was a pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Richard for joining me, and I'd love it if you would join me for a live online video chat this weekend. It's going to be this Saturday, January 30th at noon Pacific time on YouTube, and joining me from London will be Ross Semple to talk about the British version of Queer as Folk, and from Toronto, Ray Miller to talk about appearing on the American version. You can join us live in the chat. My YouTube channel name is my name, Matt Baume, MattBaume, and you can follow me on Twitter @MattBaume to get the link. Part of the appeal of Queer as Folk is that it depicted gay enclaves, the worlds we create when we engage in the gay cliché of running away from the suburbs where we grew up. But not all of us have the same vision of the life that awaits us outside of small towns. For my recommendation this week, take a look at another John Waters film, Desperate Living. It's one of his earlier works, the kind that screened for Weirdos at Midnight and will probably never be a Broadway show. Desperate Living starts on a foundation of suburbia which may look decent from the outside, but is dominated by cruel, hateful men who mask their ugliness under a thin veneer of respectability. The film's heroines, fed up with the abuse, flee to a fantasy realm that's half Disney and half garbage dump, a magic pervert shanty town full of nudists and lesbians and murder, all ruled over by an evil queen. From there, we're treated to one scene after another of hysterical panic attacks and violence and sex. For some reason, the film's New York midnight premiere was attended by critics from Good Housekeeping magazine. They walked out after 10 minutes. Desperate Living is a fairy tale, a filthy, sleazy, disgusting fairy tale, and it presents you with the choice. Which do you prefer? The creepy suburbs, where evil lurks behind false, smiling faces? Or the wild, queer hinterlands, where the inmates may run the asylum, but at least you know who your friends are? Thanks again for listening. It's listeners like you who make the show possible. If you're enjoying it, head over to Patreon and search for Sewers of Paris to pledge your support. When I started the Patreon last month, I wasn't sure what the response would be, but so far a bunch of people have stepped up to be founding supporters of the podcast, and I'm so grateful to everyone who's helping sustain the show and keep it growing in 2016. If you have any thoughts on today's episode, please get in touch. Tweet at me, at Matt Baume. You can check out the show notes at sewersofparis.com, and please keep rating and reviewing the show in the iTunes store. Those reviews make a huge difference. Check out my book, Defining Marriage, now out in paperback and audiobook. You can find it at definingmarriage.com. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.